Just to catch up where we are, we're on the early monarchy, we're on the first king. Saul is still very much in command, David's been anointed, and he's waiting. But we see conflict comes in. And I thought about this, poor David. You know, he has this great battle with Goliath, and Saul takes him into his service, as he does anybody that's found to be good. And David does everything he asks. He's a warrior. He goes out, fights the battle. He's successful. He's gone against Goliath. He's even been convinced to be the king's son-in-law against his own wishes, and he does. And yet at the same time, Saul is trying to kill him. I wondered, David is so confused at this point that last week we ended our story with going to Jonathan saying, what is it? What have I done to wrong your father? Why is he trying to kill me? And of course we saw that Jonathan says, no, he took an oath. He's not going to kill you. And yet David says, oh, yes, he is. He doesn't tell you everything. So they had that little test where David, if he didn't show up, Jonathan was to tell him where he had gone. And of course, remember that the first day Saul wasn't concerned about it, but the second day he asked Jonathan, and Jonathan just responded with a very nice, logical explanation, I thought. You know, he's asked to go home. And what happened? Saul just flew off the handle, didn't he? And he tried to kill his own son, Jonathan, and said, don't you know, as long as that man lives, as long as the son of Jesse is alive, your throne will never be realized. And so at that point, Jonathan realized that his father would stop at nothing less than killing David. What I found interesting at the end of that story was that Jonathan had returned home to the palace, but 21:10 says David fled that day. How strange. We know David. This man of great courage and strength that would stand against Goliath when he's still a young man is fleeing in fear from Saul. Well, today's lesson is going to be an interesting one because we're going to find David lying to the priests and taking refuge with the enemy. David's in God's training school, and I think he's kind of in the upper division courses at this point. This period's going to last about 15 years of David's life. And he's going to be in exile, he's going to be running, and the very core of his faith in God is going to be tested. And I want, as we go through these lessons on David, to think about David's life. Because he's considered the man after God's own heart, and yet we're going to see him fail over and over again. And if you start to look at this and say, how can this be? I want you to notice the difference between David and Saul. Every time David fails, every time he realizes he disobeyed God, and every time his sin is put before him, he confesses before God. He cries out in repentance, and he turns, and that relationship is made right with God. That's why David's a man after God's own heart, not because he does everything perfect. Heavens, he does a lot of things wrong. In fact, David's more like us than anyone. And yet, when he's confronted with his sin, when he's confronted with his disobedience, he turns to God, and that relationship is once again restored. Well, our lesson picks up again today when we see David fled, and we find out that he fled to Nob. This is very interesting because Shiloh, you remember, was destroyed. Eli was high priest. His two sons, Phinehas and Hophni, were killed that day. And we find out that the Philistines now came in and destroyed Shiloh, and Goliath's bragging about it. And he took the prized possession from the tabernacle, the Ark of the Covenant, and he took it over to the temple of Dagon. Apparently, the tabernacle and the articles in it were taken and moved to a place called Nob. And so this is where the priests are, and this is why David is going there. He's going to inquire of the Lord what to do next. When he comes, he finds Ahimelech is on duty, and he's not sure whether or not he can trust him. His brother Ahijah is the priest of Saul. Remember when Samuel left? He took Ahijah as his priest. So Ahimelech now is his brother, and he's serving in Nob. And David has three needs. He needs to inquire of the Lord, he needs food, and he also needs a weapon. He decides he's not sure where Ahimelech's loyalty lies, and so he lies to him. And he says, I'm here on the king's mission. Did you notice how Ahimelech received him? He was trembling, and he was afraid, and he says, why are you here by yourself? Where are your men? What's going on? What's happening? He was in great fear. And so David assures him that he's there on the king's business, and he says, shh, it's secret, you can't tell anybody. And Ahimelech inquires of the Lord. He goes before the Lord on behalf of David. He's done this many times before. I wondered what God told him, because he had no problems. He says, the only bread I have is the consecrated bread, and yet he gave it to David. We know about consecrated bread. That was presented to the Lord each Sabbath, 12 loaves of bread, one representing each tribe, as a thanks offering. And it presented in the holy place on the table of showbread, and that represented that they are in the presence of the Lord, Israel's 12 tribes, continually. It was each Sabbath that the cold ones were taken out, and the hot ones were there. Each week they were taken out, and they were for the priests. The priests could eat them. And yet he gave it to David. He gave 5 loaves. Interesting. God commends him. Jesus Christ commends him in Matthew 12. You might want to look at that. He actually talks about this specific event. And he says, Ahimelech did what was right because he obeyed the spirit of the law. David needed this, and he gave it to him. Now, David's anointed, so he's also authorized. He also presented him with Goliath's sword. Isn't that interesting? The only weapon in the priestly city of Nob is Goliath's sword. Now, how did that get there? Well, David, after he had won the victory, took the sword and presented it to the Lord, because it wasn't David's battle, was it? It was God's battle. And so the Lord received Goliath's sword, and it was taken and wrapped carefully and kept there with the high priest's garments. When David needed a sword, he was given the only sword in all of Nob, Goliath's. And it seemed appropriate, because this was David's weapon. He had used it, he had earned it. We've also learned that when anything's mentioned in scriptures, it's there for a purpose. And verse 7 says, now one of Saul's servants was there that day, detained before the Lord. He was Doeg the Edomite, Saul's head shepherd. So we know he's going to play a role. There's going to be trouble. We have an Edomite here. Edom is descended from Esau, who's the twin brother of Jacob. So we're following the lineage of Christ, which is Jacob, whose name is changed to Israel, and through the promised son. But Jacob had a twin brother, Esau, whose line is Edom. And we're going to find them going like this all the way through Scripture. In fact, Caesar Augustus in the time of Jesus is an Edomite. So they continue to play an important role. He's there because he's detained before the Lord. This is against his will. Apparently he's either being punished or disciplined for something. But he happens to be there when David gets there and he hears what's going on. Well, from Nob, once David has food and a weapon, he puts 30 miles between himself and Saul, and he goes to the Philistine city of Gath. I wondered what he was thinking. Why would he take refuge in a Philistine city, and of all cities, Gath? Where's Goliath from? Gath! He just beat the champion of Gath, and here he's coming into town carrying his sword. I think David maybe thought he could hide, but wouldn't David kind of stand out? He's got fair skin and red hair. And Gath is known for their size? Amazing. Maybe he thought Saul wouldn't attack him because it's a big fortified city. It's actually one of the 5 royal cities of the Philistines. Guess what? There's a popular song going around, and it's talking about David, and they're singing it everywhere. David comes into town, and they say, wait a minute, we know you. And so they go to the king, and they say, David, the king of the land, is in town. Did you notice that? They called him the king of the land. Even if Saul didn't recognize David was going to be king, the enemy knew who was going to be the next king. But I got to thinking about that. What happened when he fought Goliath? Do you remember it was a one-on-one contest? And what was to be the outcome? The loser would serve the winner. They're the losers. He's the winner. Maybe they were thinking, here comes the winner. We're already his servants, according to Goliath. Only thing is, David's all by himself, and he's brought before the king. And I think he realized his vulnerability. And did you notice what he did? Now, this is bizarre. He starts scratching on the door, letting saliva run down. And he must have been quite a good actor, because the king says, wait a minute, I've got enough insane people around here. I don't need you. And they let him go. And I thought, now, wait a minute. Why is it that he would take this man that he knew was a warrior that just beat him and believe that he's insane? Well, you know me, I love rabbit trails, so I had to check this one out, and I discovered a man's beard is practically holy. There is no way a man in his right mind would have let saliva or anything else be on his beard in public. They say a woman's hair is her crown. Well, a man's beard, it was a symbol of all sorts of things, and this is going to be important as we continue with our story. So David decides now to return to familiar territory. He made it through Gath unscathed, and he returns home to Judah, to the caves of Adullam, which means refuge. It's halfway between Gath and Bethlehem, probably an area he was familiar with. But these caves are high on cliffs, and it provided shelter for David, but let me tell you, nobody could come up on those caves without being noticed. On the other hand, everybody knew that David was out there too. And did you notice what happened? People started knowing where he was. His family came to him. I wondered, Saul's three older sons were part of Saul's army. They had seen what was happening. They know Saul's rage and anger against David. I'm sure they feared for their life. And so they took their parents and they went to David in safety at these caves. But look what else came there. 400 men distressed, in debt, and discontented. You see, God has David in training school. He's going to be the next king. He's going to need a military, and God's providing him with the raw material here. In fact, when we get into 1 Chronicles 8:12, they talk about David's royal army made out of these men, and they said they were brave warriors, ready for battle, able to handle the shield and the spear. Their faces were like the faces of lions, and they were as swift as gazelles. And we're going to find that they're intensely loyal to David. They will die for David. But life in the caves is too difficult for his elderly parents. And so he takes them to Moab. And you go, now wait a minute. Moab's an enemy of Israel. They've already been fighting them. Why would David go to the king of Moab and ask for asylum for his parents? Pop quiz. Why? Ruth. Who's Ruth? David's great-grandmother, who happens to be a Moabite. So he has ties there to Moab. So David goes and calls on that tie, and his parents are given asylum there in Moab. David then returns to his men back at the cave at Adullam. But God is directing David, and he knows it's not safe for him to stay there, so he sends Gad, a prophet, quite possibly from Samuel, and Gad says he needs to leave. In 22:5, David left and went to the forest of Hereth. Now Saul heard that David and his men had been discovered, and Saul, spear in hand, seated under the tamarisk tree with all his officials standing around him. We talked about that. Normally a scepter isn't a sword, but Saul's is a sword. He's afraid, and he wants to be prepared at all times with his sword. He's under the tamarisk tree, and word comes to him. Now, rather than being glad that he's found David, he turns on his men in rage. He says, how come you're conspiring? How come you didn't tell me where David was? And then he goes on to try to manipulate him. And he says, what do you think he's going to do? You're all from Benjamin. You think he's going to give you special favors, that he's going to make you commanders over his army? He's going to go to Judah. Interesting. We discover that most of Saul's men are only from his tribe of Benjamin, which is the smallest tribe at this point. Well, after his tirade, Doeg, the Edomite, pipes up. Now, Doeg's probably already a traitor of Edom, because Saul had gone to war against the Edomites. But Doeg's there in his service, and he says, well, by the way, I did see David. He was down at Nob, and guess what? The priest Elimelech there inquired of the Lord, gave him food and a sword. I want you to notice, he didn't say anything about the fact that Elimelech was scared, that he questioned him, that he asked him if he was on official business. He implicates him in this. Saul calls Elimelech and all the priests. Send for them. Now, they're innocent. They have nothing to hide. And so they come before Saul. He says, how come you aided my enemy? He says, now, wait a minute. David asked me to inquire of the Lord on his behalf. I do that on a regular basis. Why should I think anything different? He says, but you gave him food and a weapon. And he says, yes, but who's more loyal to you than your son-in-law, than the commander of your army? And yet Saul would not listen. He was determined to kill him. And he ordered his men to kill all the priests, but notice how his men responded. No way, they're going to touch the Lord's anointed. But there's one there who was willing to do that, Doeg. How many priests did he kill that day? 85 priests. And then he didn't stop there. He went back to Nob, and he killed their families and their animals. Is that starting to sound familiar? Do you remember what we call that? A holy war. Hareem. Who calls holy wars? Only God can call holy wars. This is a war against God. He's just killed all of the priests. It's believed he also killed Ahijah, Saul's priest. Now Saul's totally without any priests. But apparently there was one left on duty, because you wouldn't leave the temple of the Lord without a priest there should somebody come and need to inquire. And his name was Abiathar. He was the son of Ahijah. And word got to him either through the Lord or through traveling, and he was able to escape with the priestly garments. And where does he flee? To David. God's got his next king and the remaining priest together in hiding. They actually will depend upon one another, and they will become good friends, and we're going to follow their history as we go through this story of David. David actually becomes the protector of the priesthood. Well, Saul's focused on killing David. The Philistines are able to continue on with their raiding. Notice when they're attacking. After the harvest, all the work's done. Now, Saul's job as king is to protect the people. And apparently he isn't doing that, because these Philistines are coming into Keilah. This is David's territory in Judah. And David realizes it, but Saul's not coming. And so he asks Abiathar, he says, go before the Lord, inquire if I should go up. And he inquires and says, yes, go up. So David gets his men together. I mean, he's trained this army. And if any of you been in military, you know there's nothing worse than to have an army trained and ready to go and nothing to do. These men are full of energy, full of vigor. And God has a job for them to do, because this king is going to need his army. But the men say, wait a minute. This is dangerous. This is a walled city. Saul will hear about it and will essentially be sitting ducks. God said yes. His men said no. David's in the middle. And what does David do? He goes back to the Lord for confirmation, because he wants to make sure he's hearing correctly. So he goes back to the Lord, and the Lord says, yes, go and I will give you the victory. David goes. He's given the victory. Not only that, he gets great spoils of war. And he's probably thinking, oh, great, I've got a home now. I can stay in a walled city with my men, because the men of Keilah will appreciate it. But Saul hears, and David knows they're going to come. The men are afraid, and so David inquires of the Lord. He says, when Saul comes with all his army, will they turn me over? And he says, yes, they will turn you over. So once again, he's on the run, but this time he's a fugitive, an outlaw. He will continue to run and hide from Saul. But 23:14 says, day after day Saul searched for him, but God did not give him into the hands. This constant manhunt, day after day, though, caused David to be afraid, and God knew that he would need some support. And so, whereas Saul could not find David for anything, Jonathan, his son, goes right out to David and is welcomed. Verse 16, Saul's son, Jonathan, went to David at Horus and said, help him find strength in the Lord. Don't be afraid, he said. My father Saul will not lay a hand on you. You will be king over Israel, and I will be second to you. Even my father Saul knows this. Jonathan was willing to risk his life to come to David, because he knew God's plan. He expressed his belief that David will be the next king, and that he'll be the second. Do you notice how many men are with David now? The number increased. It went from 400, now we got 600 there. But they go further into the Judean hills in the desert of Ziphi. But the Ziphites consider him a rebel, and so they send word to Saul saying, we know where David is. Come out, and we'll hand him over to you. Saul says, well, you know what, I don't particularly appreciate where you live, and I want to make sure when I get out there, I'm not going to get stuck, so you make sure that you know exactly where he is. Word comes back, we know he's here. And so they come out. This is what you call a close encounter. These hills, David and his men know Saul's coming, and they're going around the backside into what will be a dead end. And Saul and his men don't know they're there, and they're coming around the other side. And they get to a place where David and his men have no escape. Their backs will be to the wall, and they're going to have to fight. But this isn't God's plan. And so once again, he uses the Philistines. They're busy raiding, and a messenger gets to Saul just at the precise moment and says, you've got to go. Saul calls it off, leaves. David and his men breathe a sigh of relief, and he names that place the Rock of Escape. But at this point, David needs refreshment. He needs encouragement along with his men. And so God brings him to a place called En-Gedi, a place of great refreshment. But once again, Saul hears of David's location, so this time he takes 3,000 men, heads out, comes to the area, and nature calls. I love this. God really has a sense of humor, doesn't he? Now, I want you to picture this in your mind. David and his men are hiding deep in a dark cave, okay? They're looking out into the bright sunlight. Saul's out in the bright sunlight, has to go in and relieve himself. So he's coming into a cave. You know what it's like when you come from light to dark. You can't see a thing. But if you're in dark looking out light, you don't have any problem, right? So he comes in, probably takes his robe off, squats down over here, and his men go, "Oh, right, God. David, he's delivered your enemy into your hand. Go get him." And David slowly creeps up. Right? Things echo in caves, too. But David doesn't kill Saul. He has the opportunity. But what does he do? He cuts the corner of his robe off, and then he creeps back to his men. They're probably sitting there, "What's the deal? I mean, a robe corner? Come on." Saul gets up, knows nothing's wrong, starts heading down. David comes back out, and he hollers out to Saul. And Saul turns around. David bows to him in honor and respect. And then he holds up the corner of his robe, and he calls him "my father," reminding him of their covenant relationship. And he suggests, "If I'd have wanted to kill you, I could have. There's others out there putting things in your mind. I have no intention of doing this. You're God's anointed. I won't touch you." And verse 12, he says, "But may the Lord judge between you and me, and may the Lord avenge the wrongs that I have done to you, but my hand will not touch to you." David's kindness disarms Saul. He's delusional. David's just proof that he's not going to kill him. There's a lot of symbolism in here. Going back to the law, Israel was required by the law to wear tassels around their garments. As they walked, the tassels would move and brush them, and it was a reminder of God's laws and the fact that they were to obey those laws. By cutting off the tassels of Saul's robe, David felt guilty because he had removed Saul's reminder to be obedient to God. And this is why he felt guilt and remorse, not from cutting his robe, but from cutting his reminder. He was essentially, symbolically separating him from his reminder of God. Saul, for his part, finally realizes what's happening. And did you notice he said, "You're more righteous than I am"? Remember what Samuel had said when he said, "The kingdom has been removed from you"? He said, "It will be given to a neighbor, one who is better than you, one who is more righteous." And he acknowledges, "David, you are more righteous than I am." And he says, "I know now that God has given you the kingdom." But did you notice what he does next? He does the same thing that Jonathan did. He asks for an oath. He says, "When you're king, will you promise to spare my descendants?" Because he knows it's just a matter of time. And David gives him the solemn oath. Saul then returns to his home. But David knows that they are not reconciled. There's no way David's going to say, "This is okay." He remains there in the hills of En-Gedi. David was in a stronghold called Masada. And the oasis there is En-Gedi. And I couldn't begin to describe it to you. But we have a wonderful teacher in Ray Vanderlaan. He's a Christian who has gone through Hebrew rabbinical school, and he's a full rabbi, but they don't know what to do with him because he can't be a rabbi. And so we have the great privilege of having his teaching. And Focus on the Family has linked up with him to do videos. For those of you that were with us 2 summers ago, we went through part of this video series. There's so many of them. But what I want to do today is take you to En-Gedi. Now, he's going to take a different turn because he's talking about water, but it's important that we understand what living water is, because we're going to be running across this a lot in the New Testament, but even in the Old Testament. What does the Bible mean when it talks about living water? We already know the significance of water in the Old Testament times, or it doesn't even matter. Anytime you're in the desert, the importance of water. And so we're going to see the significance of that. He's going to take us a little bit into the New Testament, but most of the time he's going to spend on David and Saul.